computer's online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for T120K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are a go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. In this segment we're speaking to author Paul Abbott, and his new book is Death to Justice, The Shooting of Lee Harvey Oswald. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Len. Good to be with you.
Thank you so much for taking time to talk to me today, because it's quite early where you are in Australia, and I'm in Canada, but it's different day and time zone completely, so...
Yeah,
what are you, like 14 hours ahead of me?
Yeah, the good news is tomorrow arrives. That's all I can tell you.
Yeah. Okay, thanks for the good news. Well, I think anyone, you've been on Black Op Radio several times, will bring up some of your other contributions. But today I wanted to make sure we talk about your new book, Death to Justice. And I guess my first question is, what motivated you to write on the topic of Lee Oswald?
Yeah, well, it's about the shooting more so. It's as people who read the book will realize it's not so much a biography of Lee Oswald, but really something to focus very, very deeply into his own assassination. It's a subject that gets covered in pretty much any book on President Kennedy's assassination, but it's only at best it's given a couple of pages. So, and even in the best of books like JFK and the Unspeakable and Anthony Summers' Conspiracy, they go into it for a few pages, but it just seemed to always be at the at the surface level. And it was when I was going through and compiling the Garrison Folders Index, the folders which I sourced from yourself a couple of years ago, that I was going through one particular folder. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but I think it's called literally Lee Harvey Oswald Shooting Investigation or something along those lines. And I was going through it as I did with each file, each page, looking for names and context to add onto the index. And I'm reading through this folder, and it's about 300 pages, and it didn't have any duplicate pages or anything. It was literally as the Dallas Police's own investigation, essentially into itself, how they handled the plans, the security around Oswald's transfer from City Hall to County Jail on November the 24th. And I approached it right away from a fair bit of scepticism, because there were clearly culpability on their part, yet they were allowed to carry out an investigation on itself. So it really started there, just reading these different statements from people, from various DPD personnel, and even seeing really very interesting contradictions. One person we'll get into it, but for example, one person would say something on one day, and a few days later their story would change. And I think essentially that's what really turned me onto the whole case of the Oswald shooting. There's certainly a lot more to it than I think most would understand.
Yeah, well, the book is meticulous. I mean, you've gone through almost minute by minute, just the whole thing. So if you wanted to know about the shooting, this is the book to get. I mean, there's sometimes it's almost information overload, but, you go, okay, well, he was shot in the basement and that was that. And you had more interest in that. And you said, well, tell me what really happened, because people, like you said, they say something and then they say something else. And then you later on, you read in the Warren Commission, well, they didn't write that. And then you go back and you look at the actual first day documents where somebody writes down what he thought he saw right then. And it's, and I think that's what opens up the interest to this crime, that nobody really believes that it was just a lone Marxist guy that wanted to, you know, defect to Russia or go to Cuba. It was something darker, more organized. And by studying it, we hopefully could stop it from happening again.
Mm. Although I think so. Absolutely. And I think by studying it as well, there's a chance to still make linkages to other facets of that weekend. You know, that was probably my biggest motivation for putting together the index to begin with, was, you know, little bits and pieces. It may not be too late for strands to be threaded onto other strands, and before we know it, there could be some new tangents, new evidence that emerges. So it was definitely with that in mind that I put the book together. And I'll admit, Len, I certainly didn't set out to write a book for book's sakes. I was really the way I approached it was very much looking at Oswald and really trying to grapple the context of his silencing. I think it's something that I do write in the book. It was kind of like a macabre bookend to that weekend. And of course, we have to remember that Oswald's shooting only happened, barely 47 hours after that of President Kennedy. So yeah, at that time, obviously, I wasn't around at the time, but you can certainly gather that the public would have been kind of almost numb by then with the cascade of constant reporting of Kennedy shooting, and come Sunday midday, and this guy happens to be shot as well. And I think we really it kind of almost gets lost to history how important what might have Oswald have said if he'd lived, what might have been revealed. I mean, you and I would probably agree that if he'd come to stand trial, exactly how little or how much he knew would have come out very quickly, and very 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 likely wouldn't have been able to be convicted. So it just makes this shooting all the more compelling and convenient, like you say.
Therefore, what your book goes into is the surrounding of that weekend with Jack Ruby. And all that. And then all this dialogue that he has to say he wants to tell more of his story. Mm. And nobody wants to hear it. And then he, too, is silenced. Mm. And for those who don't, some of the things, because of my interest in this for, 25 years or so, I knew several things, but every now and then something pops up. I didn't know that. And like you mentioned, indexing the Garrison files is one way where people have come up. My goodness, he figured out so much early on,
Yeah.
Yep. And Paul Blow writes the foreword for you here, and do you want to just give a quick overview of that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, it was going way, way back to the beginning of the Garrison folders. It was the work that Paul was doing at the time, and the summer of 1963, New Orleans, Oswald. He'd written some great articles back then, and I think they focused on the FPCC, and he referred to the Garrison folders. And I thought, yeah, I must check those out one day, because it sounds like Paul's really, really going through it and getting some great pieces of information out of it. New Orleans was something I didn't know too much about myself personally, so that's really where it started. And I've always looked up to Paul as a really positive collaborator. His book, The Assassination Chokeholds, JFK Assassination Chokeholds, with Jim DiEugenio, Andrew Eiler, Matt Adamczyk, and Mark Adamczyk, and Mark Crompton. Matt Crompton is a really good evidence of his collaboration, bringing things and people together. Of course, he brought Oliver Stone up to Canada for that weekend, that festival as well. So he's someone that really he's very, very passionate, very active, and very engaging. And, you know, someone I consider, you know, a mentor in terms of the way I kind of want to continue my own contributions with the JFK assassination research. I think it was Vince Palomara. I think he said on one of your interviews, actually, it might have been, that he was told, you know, if you're going to contribute anything or you know, to the cause of research, you know, find an aspect to be an an expert in, and you know, that way you'll be able to that make it yours to really hone in on. So definitely saw an opportunity with the Oswald shooting. It seems like it's something that you know, people just have a fairly general understanding of, that you know, it was Jack Ruby that somehow appeared in the basement and shot Oswald, and most people know that it was highly contentious if he actually came down the Main Street ramp. I lay out in my book that he definitely did not come down the Main Street ramp. And so when I was starting to put something together looking like a book, I reached out to Paul and just wondered if he might be interested. And it's I do approach it as if it were an onion, you know, different layers. So the way I structured it was to really just give make it as accessible to people of different knowledge levels of the case. You know, I give a very general overview of how President Kennedy's trip to Dallas came about, why he was going down there. Obviously, the movements leading up to and in Dealey Plaza with the shooting, and then the focus of attention to the manhunt, you know, in response to J.D. Tippit being shot. So I just do give a little bit of context. I don't jump straight to the minutiae of the goings on in Dallas City Hall, and I think that's important as well, because while I don't take a firm stance either way in the book that whether Oswald did it or not, I think it's almost besides the point. I do question how he left Dealey Plaza. You know, there were. I think it was five witnesses in Dealey Plaza that saw him run down Dealey Plaza from the west end of the book depository into the National Rambler wagon. People including Roger Craig identified that man as being Oswald, but then of course Oswald at the same time was identified by a lady on a bus several blocks east on Elm Street, so at the exact same time. So I do address the complexities with how Oswald might have even left the book depository and Dealey Plaza, and I also give reference to Bart Camp's fantastic work with Prayer Man, Stan Dane, Ed Ledoux, people that have worked on that side of things. So I really, really do want to, while I keep it very general, I establish context very early on, because to me it just makes Oswald's own demise incredibly more compelling. And I think the end play was ultimately that Oswald wasn't meant to survive Dealey Plaza. I think that there would be a case for that. But of course he got to live for another 40 hours and came to be shot in the basement. But I do go into a little bit of Oswald's background as well, because again, that makes him and his own death incredibly compelling. But that's only the first 30 or 40 pages. That the rest I really wanted to in the book, I really wanted to address some probably the more well known assumptions, if you like, or contentions to do with the lead up to Oswald's shooting. But again, through my work of compiling witness statements, not just from the Dallas police investigation, but I forgot all about the HSCA and worked in chronological order. So I'd read through all the DPD statements, and then compiled all the FBI statements, because I think we're most are aware that the FBI's own investigation swung in pretty much straight away. And when the Warren Commission was announced a week after President Kennedy's assassination, The FBI started to, or very very soon after that, I gather, started to dovetail its own work into what would become the Warren Report. So I compiled all witness statements that the DPD, the FBI, and Warren Commission took, and really that's when I really started to see some very very compelling narratives, some which I don't think have been brought out into the light before, and like I say, some well-known ones I cover off on, like the threats to Oswald overnight, you know, the very early Sunday morning, the threats that were allegedly phoned into the sheriff's department, and also Chief Curry's conduct with, you know, letting the press know when Oswald would be transferred the next morning. I really cover off on quite a few things, you know, over that weekend leading up to the actual, you know, the morning of November 24. So yeah, very very much a layer by layer. I want to take readers through a, you know, with a bit of context. But it is a very focused and detailed book. Once we get to the crux of exactly, you know, how everyone in the basement came to be there, whether that's media or Dallas police personnel. I literally name every person that was present in the basement at the time of Oswald's shooting. That's never been done before in terms of the media, and I think that's probably one of the biggest things that most learned people, you know, in the case may be surprised about as well. So I really do take a deep dive, but you know, layer by layer.
Right. Now, before we get too far into it, is there a website for the book? Do you have a place where people can?
Yeah, I've got a Substack. So people just look up my name, Paul Abbott. I've also got it under as Death to Justice, the shooting of Lee Harvey Oswald. So that's the best landing page. On there are links to where people can buy the paperback and Kindle version of the books. So it's available on Amazon and you know, Barnes and Noble and most online retailers. And I've also got I've set up a YouTube channel called Dallas City Hall Basement, because obviously we're talking about you know, an act that was filmed you know, and broadcast on live television. It's important to give the reader access to the film and footage that I refer to a lot in the book. And it's not just the seconds of Oswald shooting, but I'm not sure if you're aware of this, Len, but there's some very, very interesting raw footage that was taken down in from the basement by one of the KRLD TV cameras, and it's literally from when the armored car that was originally planned to take Oswald to the jail, when it arrives and is being searched and kind of pans around to find its frame for filming when Oswald is brought out of the jail office. And I use that quite a bit and refer to it a lot in the book to time various people's movements and you know, the comings and goings on in there. It's in the basement. It's very useful. So I've just made that additional resource available as well. So as people are reading through the book, there's a couple of online resources that are like companion pieces.
Good. Make sure you email me those links. We'll add them to the show note links. Very good. Right. Now, back at arm's length, I guess I've asked you on other occasions, you know, what was a catalyst, what sparked them to really get into the case. But as you got into this section of, you, like you just mentioned, that you read some documents and the Warren Commission and they seem to conflict with them. Is there one item, though, that would stand out to say, well, this seemed so wrong, I knew I had to dig into it?
Yeah, it's going to sound funny, but I'm not sure if you're familiar with two of the photographs that were taken of the shooting. So we obviously got Robert Jackson, who won the Pulitzer Prize for the moment that Ruby shoots Oswald. And then there is another one that was taken by Jack Beers, who's literally standing above to the right of Jackson, two facing where Oswald's being brought out. He took a photo of as Ruby is lunging forward. And it's going to sound a little bit funny, but again, it's the smallest things, I suppose. But in the bears photograph, you can see a microphone very clearly hanging down over the heads of some of the reporters, including Ike Pappas, who, of course, was the gentleman that lunged himself his microphone towards Oswald and tried to ask him a question just before he was shot. So you see a microphone in the bears photograph, but it cannot at all be seen in the Jackson photograph. Now, that is what always piqued my interest, just that something did not quite seem right about the Oswald shooting. But what I did was kind of pulled away back from that. And, it was when I was compiling these various witness statements that I really thought that, you know what, there are some of the things that people are saying just did not happen, did not take place on camera. And I'll give you a very, very quick early example of finding of mine. Detective Graves, he was holding Oswald's left arm. He was the other detective in black, whereas Lavelle was standing on Oswald's right side, and he was in the cream white suit and the Stetson hat. Well, Graves, in his typed an unsigned statement in the Dallas police investigation, said that when Oswald was shot, he was immediately loaded into an ambulance and rushed to hospital. Now that absolutely did not take place. It was almost 5 minutes before an ambulance arrived and Oswald was wheeled out of the jail office and taken away in an ambulance. So right there, I'm seeing a very, very clear contradiction, you know, in terms of what we can see on footage and almost everybody else's testimony. And I just thought, well, that's strange. How can we have such a big, you know, difference of an account there? But probably the other thing was the fact that Oswald wasn't put into a car straight away after being shot and rushed to hospital. Why was he picked up and taken back to the jail office and an ambulance was called? Why was he not put into a car that he was about to be loaded into anyway? And rushed directly to Parkland. So that was always a very early question for me. But I kind of put those questions on the back burner, because I think what is easy to do when you research is that you can everything that you look for might be biased by some kind of predetermined outcome or end note final explanation. Whereas for me, I put all those to a side and literally that compelled me to go through every single statement that was made to really, really get a sense of what went wrong. And I think that was far more valuable. I had no idea how the hypothesis that I conclude the book on would come to be. That was the last thing I wrote, based on all the evidence that I reviewed. So it was very much a start to finish kind of process.
Well, no, that's very interesting. I'm very interesting to hear that, but because everyone's different and hundreds of people have an interest in the case, if not thousands and whatever, but everyone seems to have a little different thing. I used to say to people when I saw Commission Exhibit 399, I just went, wait a minute, something's wrong. There's just no way, like, regardless of Lee Oswald defecting to Russia and doing the, regardless of all that, that bullet, that Commission Exhibit 399, like, and if they're lying about that right in the open, let's look into it further, right?
100%. Yeah, well, absolutely. Some of the things that I just stated and a few more things were definitely my CE39 for the Oswald shooting, that's for sure. I definitely found quite a few early on in the piece and just kept pulling on this string.
Now, when did you start writing? How long did it take you to get into this?
So it was actually while I was still doing the index. I'd kind of while I was having a break from putting the index together, I was compiling all of the witness statements. You know how the index is, Len. It's a spreadsheet. I like spreadsheets, so I just summarised every single statement into a pretty simple simple spreadsheet, and really was able to note and see very early how inconsistent the statements who were asked to give statements very early on. The Dallas Police, just to go on another quick tangent. It's amazing who they did not interview. I think I say in my book they carried out 121 statements. Some were members of the press. I think they acknowledged that there were 22 members of the press in the basement, but they only interviewed 10, for example. And you read into it a little bit more, the explanation, I think, from McGagran, who I think was the inspector that led the investigation, said that there were some budgetary and time constraints, so they weren't able to call people back from reporters back from New York or Miami after the fact. But they overlooked some very, very important people. People like Fred Bieberdorf. He was the young first aide, the medical intern that was called to the jail office to tend to Oswald after he'd been shot. And I'm looking for Bieberdorf's statement from the Dallas Police. He still worked at City Hall. It's not like he wasn't accessible, but he was completely ignored, as were, there were quite a few civilian workers. So when I say civilian workers, it's people like porters, maintenance workers that worked across the City Hall complex, all completely ignored. And I just thought, okay, there's something quite not right in Dodge City here. That's probably one of the more probably the newer aspects that I shed on the case as well. And I was very fortunate that Jim D'Eugenio was happy for me to release to have that chapter on Kennedys and King, which I think it still is. It's called Civilians Overlooked. These are people that probably most have never heard the names of before, because they were just not given any kind of recognition in terms of asking for their statements on the day by the Dallas Police. And it was really the only the Warren Commission, months after the fact, that came back around and interviewed these people, and porters and who were in the, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, Len, the porters that were in the basement.
Yeah, go on.
Yeah, so they were there was a group of seven people that were just standing over in the eastern end of the basement, watching all the camera crews and the media getting ready. They were hoping to stand right over the other side of the basement car park to watch Oswald being brought out. And as I write in my book, it was a fair assumption on their part that they would be allowed to, because they were, they were employees. They were personnel of the building. Granted, they weren't police, but anyway, it was their assumption that they would just be able to, if they stayed out of the way and literally out of sight, because the media were filming, had their backs to them, they would be able to stay put. But as it happened, a reserve officer was sent over to them to tell them to leave, basically. You can't be here. So these civilian workers, they went up the elevator up to the annex building, which was the smaller building, still is there, next to the older City Hall building. They all thought, well, okay, we'll walk across the annex building to City Hall and we'll watch the transfer happen at the Commerce Street entrance, the main entry behind the glass doors there, because that's obviously where the armoured truck would be brought out to take Oswald away. Well, they just stood there for about an hour waiting, and two of them peeled off, Harold Fuqua and Alfredia Riggs. And these two people are very important to highlight, because their story from here on really highlights how insecure, how easy it was for people to access the City Hall building, even in that time in the lead up to the shooting. Because what these two men did was they walked the same way that they'd came with the others, back through old City Hall building, back through the annex building, and they actually, in the hope of finding a television to watch the transfer take place. So they knew that there was one in the locker room of the City Hall basement, or it was actually in the sub-basement, so a level below the basement level of the City Hall. So Riggs and Fuqua go on this journey to basically leave the building altogether, walk around the outside, and then enter through another entrance. And their path is very interesting. When they left the annex building, they did so through a hatch out of the back of a service elevator of the annex building, which led to an outer door, which opened up to a small alleyway, which was on that vacant block between the annex building and, coincidentally enough, the Western Union office where Jack Ruby came from to carry out his money transfer about an hour or so later. So these Fuqua and Riggs go through the leave through the service elevator. They leave out at the, you know, the service entrance outer door. They locked it behind them. That's very important. They told the Warren Commission that they made sure that the door was locked behind them. They walk to Main Street. They actually walk along the front of the annex building and the City Hall, and they encounter Roy Vaughan. Now, Roy Vaughan might be a familiar name to you. He was the police officer that was based at the top of the Main Street ramp. It was immediately thrown on to him that either let Jack Ruby walk down the Main Street ramp or was too busy letting a car out to notice Jack Ruby slip by. But I'll get to that later. But anyway, Vaughan remembers these two men coming walking along. So we've got their story corroborated to this point. They keep walking past the basement entrance of Main Street and around to the Harwood Street entrance. And they determine that it's clear for them to walk down the steps from the street level to the basement, and because there's no police there to stop them, and they find their way down to the sub-basement locker room. So right there, that story tells you how, you know, insecure and easy the City Hall was to both get in and most importantly enter. But they were actually turned away from the locker room downstairs by someone that they chose not to identify. I was telling them, there's no point watching the transfer on the TV here. It's not going to be shown it's not going to be broadcast live on television anyway, so you need not bother. So I actually go to fair length in my book to identify who that person was and why they would be so potentially so cagey about sharing this large locker room with, two civilian workers. But, that's an interesting little story, that a little tangent that, I've got quite a few in my book that people, you've really got to dig deep into the Warren Commission, the FBI's reports that ultimately dovetailed into the Warren Commission to find. But again, important little stories that potentially bring together a fairly clear idea of exactly how Oswald's shooting came to happen, and the fact that there were Confederates in Dallas City Hall, DPD members that the I posit were there to help make it happen, help Ruby gain entrance and swing into action immediately with the cover-up.
Yeah, that's a whole interesting area of the book that you go right into. It's just Ruby, how it came to happen, who was there,
yeah.
Names, dates, and places. So you really feel that you're right there. It's almost minute by minute explaining to anyone interested, really, with this kind of historical biography of the incident. Just who was there and how could this happen?
Yeah.
Unless these guys are in on the con.
Well, it's The thing that I think most people are aware of, or is most well known about the case, is the amount of, or the fact that the media were allowed to actually be present for the transfer to begin with, and that started with the Saturday, the afternoon before, Chief Curry, Dallas Police Chief Curry, asking Captain Fritz, who was personally, and his detectives within the Homicide and Robbery Bureau were handling Oswald's interrogations. Curry was, quick to ask Fritz the afternoon before, when will you be finished with Oswald? When do you want? When can he be transferred? I have to tell these people. So these people being the press, what's happening? So there was a real obedience from the DPD in terms of the media, and that was actually systemic. I reference that in my book as well, that Curry himself issued a kind of a mandate that was released to across all Dallas personnel, that they're basically, I have it verbatim in my book, but the nuts and bolts of it is that they're to aid and assist members of the media wherever possible. So it was kind of like the Dallas police were using the media as their PR arm. They wanted to always look at you being their good graces. So obviously that would have been a mutually beneficial arrangement. If the Dallas police gave the media good access, then the press would be positive, and might not look too far into clearly corrupt goings on within Dallas police. But back to Curry, he broadcast to the media that it's become over the years that he told the media that if you come back by 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, you won't have missed anything. I picked up on a few statements which actually nail that down to be more like Oswald will be transferred at 10 o'clock the next morning. So here he is, even the afternoon before, laying out when Oswald's going to be transferred. So it's kind of like he's broadcasting, getting whoever he needed to his attention to say, hey, this is when we're moving Oswald. Be ready. That is what that could be construed as. But it gets even worse. I'll go into the threats overnight in a minute. But the next morning, as late as 20 past 10, on the Sunday morning, so an hour before Oswald would eventually start the transfer and be shot, Curry was still holding court with the press up on the third floor, and he was telling them that we had threats overnight, and we by rights we should have transferred Oswald overnight and for his safety, but I'm a man of my word, I keep my promise, I told you that we would be transferring Oswald this morning, and that's what we're doing. And, of course, members of the press, latched, obviously sensed the lead there and said, well, what threats? So Curry was very quick to detail the threats that were allegedly phoned in and therefore how they were actually going to transfer Oswald, to the point of laying out that he would be taken down in the elevator, out through the basement, into an armoured car, and even being answering which company was providing the armoured car. The Dallas police chief is laying out exactly how the transfer is going to happen. No element of security, no regard for the element of surprise. Does that make Curry, a part in the plot? I'm not sure. He's either incredibly culpable or incredibly stupid. But, actions speak louder than words. And unfortunately, with the passage of time, we can only really, we're still left to guess. But, it does make you wonder. It really does. Curry's conduct that morning, the threats themselves, and you would have heard of Billy Grammer.
But for those who haven't.
Billy Grammer was he was working on the phones at Dallas City Hall. He was a police officer as part of the patrol division. His name only came out after the shooting. He testified that he took a phone call. He was never definitive on his time. Over the years, it ran from 9 p.m. Saturday night until the early hours of Sunday morning. So it was never a clear time as to when this phone call came in. But he said that this man was called in to say that, there's a committee of 100 people that are going to attack Oswald's convoy, and Oswald will not make it to the county jail alive. He even was able to, apparently, the caller knew that Oswald would be moved in an armoured car when it hadn't been announced at that stage. It hadn't even been decided within the Dallas police planning. But this caller somehow knew that, an armoured car would be used. So that's pretty suspicious. Grammer said that he filed out an affidavit, but Curry never received it, or it was lost. There's never been a copy that's been able to be produced. People that were there at the time in City Hall working the night shift, no one else corroborated any direct calls being made to the police about lodging threats on Oswald's life. And the thing was that Billy Grammer said, I only recognised after the fact that it was Jack Ruby calling. I didn't recognise it to be Ruby's voice, you know, when I was on the phone to him. And oddly enough, Grammer was friends with Jack Ruby and apparently caught up with him only earlier that same day on Saturday. So, you know, there's quite a few, quite a few, you know, when we're relying on literally the word of only one person, and even then it's an after-the-fact account, I don't hold much credence to it. And with when reading the FBI statements, they were it's very clear to see that they were looking for any linkages between Dallas police personnel and Jack Ruby. So here we had an instance of Grammer allegedly saying that, you know, my friend Jack Ruby, who I only recognised to be Jack Ruby after the case, called in a threat to on Oswald's life. The FBI would have been all over Billy Grammer because you've got connection between Grammer and Ruby. And then obviously what transpired with Ruby shooting Oswald. So, but the FBI, the Warren Commission, never touched Grammer. There was never any interview by him. So I delve into that a little bit because that is important. And the threats, you know, there were threats that were phoned in to the Dallas Sheriff's Office. One directly from a person that was part of this committee, but only before that, the Dallas FBI rang the Sheriff's Department and said, oh, have you had any phone calls, any phone calls of threats? Because we have, you know, threats on Oswald's life. So the sheriff deputy that was on duty that night said, yes, I have had a call, come to think of it. So the FBI office then called Dallas Police, the City Hall, and spoke with Captain Frazier, not Billy Grammer, Captain Frazier, and asked him the same. Have you had any calls, you know, threatening Oswald's life? And Frazier said no, none have come in. So the word on the, you know, in terms of the threats of this committee that I lay out in my book originate from the FBI. So we're not even sure how legitimate they were, and there was no testimony or anyone that was, you know, in Dallas, you know, on the streets of on that Sunday, seeing an angry mob anywhere either, Len. That's the thing as well. No one, there was no committee, no vigilante group that were lining the streets waiting for Oswald in the armoured car or anything. So I just delve into that. That's a more well-known aspect of the case, which I just, again, through reading through the statements, just going, you know what, this does not make sense, what is being put forth, but what was actually the people that, you know, that were directly involved, that there are contradictions here. So I lay those out in the book as well.
Yeah, just the amount of people that were there, some of the staff and goings on that I was not aware of, and you've got names of, well, all the people. So there's names and everything. It's just a treasure trove if you're interested in learning more about this incident, right? And, you know, I think people tuning into Black Op Radio, so many people are. So it's an ideal target audience for, you know, for this.
And I hope so. I think probably the biggest thing that will surprise people is the proportion of Dallas police to media. I do a head count, and there is a 50-50 ratio. You know, they were based on statements and obviously film and photographic footage I use to pinpoint people in the immediate scene, but there were 46 members of the media in the basement within the vicinity of Oswald shooting, 46. And through, again, the same exercise, it's 46 Dallas police personnel, including reserve officers, detectives, and various captains, supervisors, 46 members of the police there as well. So all up, 92 people standing around, not including Oswald and Ruby, watching this horrible event take place. And it's no wonder how easily Ruby was able to be let in to carry it out. And I do concur with John Armstrong and David Josephs. They make the very strong case that Ruby was let in, and it was through that outer door that I was talking about before, that leads out to the vacant block. I think that, that was very, very, very easy thing to let happen because the civilian workers were cleared away. That's why they were cleared away, because the fix was in. That's how Oswald Schuster was going to be let in, so they couldn't have non-police personnel nearby to watch this to watch this man be let out of the or to be to literally come out of the stairwell from the annex building, quickly walk across the the car park. It's how it was depicted in Oliver Stone's JFK. That's literally how it only could have happened. And I'll just bring it up to the HSCA. They were probably the House Select Committee. They were probably the most thorough. They gave most time to looking into Oswald shooting. So, before or after checking out my book, I'd always point people to the report within the shooting in the HSCA's final report, because they do go into it a little bit more. But I was able to add to it, because obviously I wasn't constricted by the politics of the time and whatever agenda the HSCA were operating to, of only, looking probably too far into things as well. But the HSCA put forth four possible scenarios of how Ruby could have entered the basement. I'm not too sure people are aware of that even. But the first one was obviously down the main street ramp, and so past Roy Vaughan, and literally down the ramp to perfectly be in place for when Oswald emerged. That was scenario number one, which they do heavily discount, credit than that. Another scenario was that Ruby had a press pass. He literally just posed as a member of the press and was able to enter through any of the kind of the public doorways, entrances up in the old City Hall building. And another way, if he'd was helping to wheel a camera into place down in the basement, still pretending to be one of the press. That's the third way. And then the HSCA do acknowledge the avenue of entry that John Armstrong and myself contend, which is through that outer door on the eastern end of the basement car park. They didn't land on that definitively, but they said, and I quote, that was the most attractive option for how Ruby could have entered the basement. So, the HSC, they did, they went into it so far, but obviously, with a little bit more benefit of time and technology. Yeah, I've obviously been able to dig a little bit deeper in a shorter period of time.
Well, congratulations for that, because I think anybody listening to Black Op Radio will be interested in this, and I recommend this as just as condensed. This is everything about this incident that you really want to know, and it's all here. I'll just go over some of the chapters of Harvey Oswald, Inmate 54018, the first shooting, aftermath, preparations, civilians overlooked, the media, chapter on the police, chapter 10, countdown, and then 11 and 12 are on the shooter, then the Ruby trial, and consolidation.
And so I bring it all together. I want to make it as easy. JFK, books on the JFK assassination are obviously very complex, and they can go in all kinds of directions. So once I landed on the idea of putting this into a book, I wanted to be as focused as possible, because that's where I really admire other people's work when they really focus in on a particular topic. And the last bit that I finish on in this book is, like I said before, an hypothesis. I've stated all of the evidence, and then I use it to lay out a narrative of how the Dallas City Hall was prepared for the shooting. I name suspicious officers that were in place to allow Ruby access. Another officer that was down in that locker room and close to payphones, therefore to have contact with with external and internal phone lines to potentially give Ruby the instructions or the you know the heads up of to you know when to come and make his transfer, you know money transfer to Western Union and but you know to, by making the his act look spontaneous. So I lay it all out, and the immediate cover-up starts. Len, I'm not sure if you've watched the footage, but it's on my YouTube channel. There's a police officer that immediately covers Jack Ruby with a black bag-looking object. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't been to your chapter. I mean, your YouTube channel. So,
yeah, yeah.
So,
No, it's
well, you'll send me the link, and I'll start there.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's a very quick act that, you know, and it is clear. It's not something that you need to squint to notice. You just have to slow the shooting footage down to see this hatless man, who I name as Lewis Miller, a detective, come into the swing into action to cover Jack Ruby's head. Now, you know, if it was just a spontaneous act that Ruby somehow just ended up in the basement at the right time to shoot Oswald. How was this man so prepared and ready to swing into act, you know, so quickly to cover up the shooter? So again, I see it as opening up a new paddock, you know, a new area in this topic that we're all very interested in. And I lay it all out in a hypothesis. I don't claim it to be, you know, the definitive version of what happened, but using the evidence that I cite and that I reference in the book, I think it gives a very, very good idea, and it will surprise people how elaborate the plot was, but how smoothly it was able to take place. And I guess my goal with this is, and I'll keep working on this topic because there will be more things to delve into and bring out, but I just would like Oswald's shooting to be a topic worthy of its own research. You know, like I said at the start, it's one of those things that people know a little bit about, or you've got, you know, so there's some kind of fringe or researchers out on the fringe that cut straight to the, you know, the very, very suspicious things about their microphone and Jack Ruby's hairline, you know, when he's shooting Oswald, and that it couldn't have been Ruby and all of that kind of stuff. Well, I'm filling in the landscape between, because I think that the things that are actually plain and clear in the evidence gives a pretty good explanation of what happened. And then beyond that, well, okay, maybe we can look into some more, you know, some more alternative type theories of you know that can be found. So I just want to prove that it's a topic that really should be given its own case of research, because Oswald had family. You know, his two daughters would have grown up hearing obviously everything about their father, and obviously so many unanswered questions like we all have. But to their degree, as their father, it's as their daughters. I can only begin to imagine. So there's a little bit of that in mind with it, as well as to give his death the respect that it deserves.
Well, you outlined the opposition to Kennedy early on, and I guess the introduction or maybe the preface, just that, you know, there were some big things going on here, and here was somebody had to be dealt with. And here is the patsy, the fall guy, and let us explain what happened. Yeah. But it's very good that you just kind of put the magnifying glass on this area and really got into it.
It's a bit from out from the left field. It's my first book. So, you know, I'd just encourage anyone that's interested to at least check out my YouTube or Substack and go from there. But it is a book that, is very evidence-based. You know, I don't...
Well, that's the whole thing people are looking for. They want to know what's out there and what they might not know about the topic, and in this instant. So this is great. Now, you did mention earlier, just moving along then, that there was something you wanted to mention about the indexing of the Garrison tapes. Was that right?
Yeah. Well, I would just it was obviously the catalyst for me writing this book, and I suppose it's I'm not sure, Len. You'd be able to tell me this, that if other people are using the index, but I guess I Through putting it together, I kind of found, used it to the purpose that I wanted to put it together for, was to just sensibly organise, all so many names and so many tangents that Jim Garrison was able to uncover, not just during his investigation in the 60s, but as you well know, he never stopped looking, never stopped writing about the case. He was very interested in another world events. He clearly found threads to pull on that he thought were interesting and might have been linked to obviously the coup d'etat that happened in 1963. So in putting his important work together in an hopefully a very palatable resource that people can use, I guess I've done that with this book. A lot of the impetus and the foundations of going down this pathway was through that index. So I would just encourage anyone out there, it is freely available. You're very good and decent to continue to make the files and folders available to anyone, I gather, and the index as well. So
yeah, I include it with the files, right? So
yeah, so it's never too late. We're 60 years after the fact, and it's never too late to potentially uncover new facets, and with that, more pieces of the puzzle on this giant board that we look down on. So I'd encourage people to use the index, because a name is very, it can go a long way. After your recent interview with Vince Palomara, and thank you, Len, you put me in contact with Vince. I reached out to him to say Lloyd John Wilson, who he spoke about on the show with you in regards to the Chicago plot. I found that was a name that was familiar to me from the index. So I sent Vince the documents that I was able to index in the out of the Garrison folders, and hopefully they will help or corroborate or bolster the excellent work that Vince has done and will no doubt continue to do. So it's a resource for everyone to learn from, but also share and collaborate. And that's what we need to do. We obviously have sections and different people of different beliefs in the research community, but in the name of getting as close to uncovering the truth as possible, the way you operate, Paul Blow, Jim, the Dallas, the DPUK, so many researchers all over the world. We can still come together and collaborate, and that's important.
All right, very good. Well, I wish you success in the book, and it's worth it and interesting, and some things will be, researchers will be aware of some of the facts, but I mean, that's it, you get something to find out what you don't know, or it reaffirms, here's what someone else has discovered, and I'll have to go through your YouTube channel, because I was unaware of it, so.
Yeah, I've just put it up, but it's a companion piece to the book.
Maybe you better put it up on Rumble too, because YouTube is censoring things.
That is a good point. Yeah, I think I will actually, but no, I appreciate it, Len. Yeah.
Well, send me an email link if you do have a Rumble channel too. All right. Well, it was Death to Justice, and thank you so much. We've been speaking to Paul Abbott, and thank you for getting up very early for you. And I appreciate that, making time, and keep in touch. And send me links, anything you think appropriate for we'll add to the show notes here.
Absolutely. Thanks, Len. And I'd just like to give you a shout out for Fletcher Prouty's Cold War as well. I watched that recently. You and Jeff Carter did a fantastic job with that. So, I wanted to mention that as well. I think that's very useful.
I can tell you one thing that happened, that Oliver Stone sent me a note, and he said this is a major accomplishment. He said you should be very proud, and he said that Fletcher would have been very happy with this documentary done of him. And so, I phoned Jeff right away just to say, wow, well, if Oliver thinks this good, and he's made so many documentaries, it's like,
fantastic.
So thank you for your critique of it, that you thought it was worthwhile as well. And
Absolutely. Recommend it to anyone to watch. It's a very, very important piece of coverage of history. It was very good.
All right, Mr. Abbott, thank you so much again.
Thanks, Len.
We'll talk in the near future.
Cheers.
Okay, good night.
You're listening to Black Op Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. In this segment, we are speaking to David Denton. Hello.
Lynn, how are you doing?
Good. I wanted to help promote a conference that you're putting on. It's an annual thing, and you've put on several over the years, and I just wanted to let people know. And so I give you the floor to help sell some seats.
Well, we're back in Dallas this year. We had a great event last year, and Project JFK, collaboration with them, JFK Conferences, LLC. We're kind of a two or three groups that kind of collaborate together. I kind of headed up, and we had a terrific event last year at the 60th anniversary, and we're anticipating another good one this year. It's November 21 through 24 in Dallas at the Doubletree Inn and on Market Street, and we've got a terrific lineup. Our keynote speaker this year is Doug Horn, who's obviously, I think everybody that's associated with the JFK case is aware of Doug. He's excellent researcher, former investigator for the Assassination Records and Review Board. Really knowledgeable about the autopsy and the medical evidence that he examined in the 90s when he worked for that congressional committee. And Doug has been a prolific writer. He's a good speaker. We're actually going to have him not only have his keynote speech on Saturday night, he's also going to be moderating a medical panel, again, about things associated with the autopsy and the medical evidence. Two other really excellent people in terms of knowledge about the case, Dr. David Manick, Dr. Mike Chesser. They'll be both on that panel on Saturday afternoon. We really look forward to that one. I think a lot of people anticipating that. And then, you know, you go from there. We've always have a mix of new folks and folks that you've done things for us before that have been loyal to our cause, so to speak. And we try to, you know, people are always digging, trying to find new information in this case. It seems like there's always something there, something new to examine. So we look forward to presenting that to the public. Some other of our speakers, Ed Tatro, excellent, always been an excellent speaker, always done great with research. He's got some new things that he's going to be talking about in Dallas. Mal Hyman, who wrote a great book about the media and the JFK assassination, who is actually running for Congress in South Carolina. If he wins, he will be officially a congressman. But either way, he said he's coming to Dallas. Excellent speaker. Larry Rivera, who's done so much work with a whole range of things associated with the JFK case. He's worked a lot on the new stuff he's done, new technology with the Z film. He's a guy that comes to mind. And again, a lot of folks, I'm sure I'm going to miss out on some people, but Brian Edwards, nationally known researcher, and along with Casey Quinlan from Kansas City, David Knight, who's also kind of co-chairs the conference with me, has done some great research himself, all those guys from Kansas City and Project JFK, and Ryan Jones, who's from the Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, Tennessee, their resident historian, always does a great job analyzing and talking about the King assassination, bringing new elements into that story. Bev Sadowski, who will be our kind of a resident expert on the RFK assassination. We try to focus on those three in the 1960s. And I think they're the things that kind of stand out in terms of what folks the political assassination of the 1960s still want to look at, still want to see and looking for answers. So that's some of the folks. And of course there are many more, Rick Russo, really underrated, but tremendous researcher who will be, again, speaking on the medical evidence. He's a guy who collaborated with Nigel Turner with the Men Who Killed Kennedy series. So that's just a some of the many great speakers we have. It'll be a fantastic weekend. And we just encourage folks to go to our website. It's really easy, jfkhistorical.com. Or if you just put in JFK Historical Group, and you'll see our homepage, and you can scroll down. You find out how to register. We're we're offering a couple different, actually three different options. Folks who want to spend the entire weekend can sign up for that. We have some one-day passes for folks that might be, you know, kind of popping in and out. Maybe there's a couple other conferences in town that weekend. They may choose to do that, local people. And we'll be offering on Zoom, too. I mean, a lot of folks that simply can't make it. It's going to be a great weekend. We encourage them to sign up with Zoom. So that's kind of a little – I gave you a quick synopsis there, Lynn.
Oh, very good. The JFK Historical Group, and then you can find out more and how to sign up for Zoom and how to attend. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that people knew that you were putting something on in case there was some other things that people would maybe not be as interested in. They might find yours of more interest.
Well, I mean, again, it's a thing that's folks – there's a finite group of folks that are passionate about this story, right, that make these events. And then there's, you know, some the general public who still has an interest in it, you know. I mean, and I get that. And, you know, when we get to anniversaries, you know, like the 60th anniversary last year, obviously that drew more national attention, drew more – actually a lot more media coverage – yet there are folks that are always there that are still seek out truth and justice for JFK. And I think that's obviously Martin Luther King, RFK too. I think, you know, some folks are mistaken to think that or some kind of jaded about what sometimes these conferences are all about. And maybe there's some situations where they are, but you know, they might be misconstrued what we're at. We're not out to make a buck. If we were, we'd be doing something else. It's always a
labor of love.
Yeah, that's it. We don't come out. If we come out even Steven on these things, we consider ourselves lucky. We're doing it because we're passionate about it. You know, I think that's the primary goal, to advance the cause, to keep people interested in the case, pursue justice and truth. And hopefully we'll get a little bit closer to that in Dallas this coming November. It's getting close, right? November 21. So it's right around the corner. So
yeah. You've attracted some really good speakers, right? And people who already know of the case will know of the like you started off with, you know, these heavy hitters. So I just, you know, in case anyone didn't know that about it, I just want to make sure that, you know, here we are almost at the beginning of November, that people thought, oh, he's putting that on, good. And we'll make links to your website.
Well, terrific. Again, and let's just, you know, to let folks know, you know, the reason why we do have great lineups and speakers, because folks recognize that we do a pretty professional job, that we you know, stay on track. We're not disorganized. We put a good product out there, and I think folks have began to see that, and that's part of the reason why we've been able to continue to do this. But again, encourage everybody to at least take a look at what we've got, and maybe might pique their interest about being a part of that weekend.
Exactly. The thing I like about just trying to support people doing good research is you can get down to the nitty, you know, argue about something. Oh, is that Lee Oswald in the doorway or not? Or is that lovely? You can have these discussions, but it's not going to be the Warren Commission was right. Lee Oswald was the lone assassin. Some of these kind of like McAdams type people that are at maybe at competing conferences. I just, you know, you don't want to stay away from that. Here's the best, latest research, and you may or may not agree with everything, but here's what we know so far. That's what
I think you've just pretty much described our philosophy about it. I mean, we have people with different opinions about what happened in Dallas, who was involved with it, but we pretty much draw the line. We're not going to bring in the McAdams. We're not going to bring in Gerald Posner.
Okay, yeah,
guys like that.
These guys' names. No, you've got a really good list, so that's good. And I urge everybody to check out your website just to start with and say, okay, exactly who do they have and what is it? And okay, well, I'm glad you made time for me, because I know I had a hard time just connecting with you. That's good. Before we were to wrap up, is there anything else you want to get to I didn't bring up?
No, I think we pretty much covered it. And
right. And your website tells the story there.
Yeah, jfkhistorical.com. And I'm sure folks will once they see our full lineup, I think that would encourage people to look. You know, there were other names I didn't mention in the whole process, but check out our whole lineup, and hopefully we'll see some folks in Dallas, Lynn. And thanks for your time, man, for having me on.
Right. No, just always willing to promote good work. All right, well, thank you again then, and we'll keep in touch via email.
All right, thanks, Lynn.
All right, good night.
Stay in touch. Thank you. Okay. Bye.